And welcome to the Rock and Roll Survivors Podcast, dedicated to those in front of the curtain, behind the curtain, and somewhere in between. So let's get started. I am so excited about this episode because there are some wonderfully scandalous things that you have said in a few episodes that I have just kind of let go by. But we have been talking about the early days of Dave Leon and his groundbreaking teen club in Harper Woods, which is right near where you lived in Grosse Pointe. And it was called The Hideout. And it opened in 1964. And we are definitely going to be talking about The Hideout a lot, especially when it expands and goes elsewhere. And we also really need to talk about Dave Leon's partner, Punch Andrews, or as your brother called him, Punchy.
Yes.
I don't want to talk about Punch in this episode because, well, first of all, he was too pivotal and I don't want to give him short shrift. But the main reason why I don't want to talk about Punchy right now is because I want to focus on something you said about the early days of The Hideout when it first opened up in May of 1964. You said, quote, "It was like horny teens in a sweatbox." So I'm just going to let you run with that, my friend.
I could not have worded it better. That phrase stays with me. That's exactly what it was. Horny teens in a sweatbox. Sweat on the walls pouring down. Floors were slippery with it. Everyone dancing their fool heads off. I mean, picture it. It's May 1964 and school is out. Rock and roll teens in Detroit are restless, okay? Something had to give. Suddenly, The Hideout crashes onto the scene, the brainchild of Dave and Punchy, and suddenly the music-starved kids have this place to hang and call their own. It became an instant home to so many teen bands and the equally crazed teens that came to hear the music. Dave had to open the front door and the back door to let in some air because it was so packed so quickly. And it was the same script every night. Kids line up outside the door, pay their dollar to get in. Bands start. The place is rocking. Dave opens the door for air, The neighbors call the police, bitching holy hell. The cops come, they break up fights or just calm it down, and it starts all over again the next Friday night as the teens partied on.
Well, I have two really, this one's a gross question, and I'm sorry for the listeners, but you said a bunch of horny, sweaty teens, and he had to let air in. I mean, the smell just makes me...
You think we noticed? We didn't give a shit. We were there having fun. Nobody gave a damn.
True, true. And there, those hormones were probably raging, let alone with the music pulsing.
Oh, yes.
You had said just briefly in this whole little moment with the doors being let open that it led to fighting. Did you say that? That this led to? So talk a little bit about that.
It wasn't all the time, okay? You know, the sign of the times, I have to explain this, the sign of the times at that point, Motown was drawing from the inner city music. That's what it appealed to, you know, R&B and soul. The Hideout, from its inception, called strongly to the suburbs music and the newly discovered British music coming in. So there was a lot of different music bubbling up all of a sudden. And I suppose at the start, the Hideout seemed to have more of a frat reputation because it was in Grosse Pointe. But I mean, honestly, to be real about it, Dave drew from all the different suburbs, all the demographics. He booked everyone from all different places. We had frats, we had greasers, all types. And I'm sure there were fights of all types as the different demographics sort of collided at times, right? And they were ginned up on the music and perhaps whatever alcohol they had consumed before coming to the alcohol-free Hideout. So yeah, there were fights now and then. It wasn't excessive, but they happened. And the cops did have to break them up. I remember him having bouncers at a few points, I think. I'm not positive, but I seem to remember him having to hire a couple guys to sort of watch things. And the music, honestly, between this fighting, whatever was happening, you know, I mean, the greasers would knock the long hairs. You know, I mean, it was this whole thing. But music became the unifying force, gritty, raw, whether it was the Brit music, R&B, or a new mix from the teen bands doing their own style of music from their area. You know, it began firing on all pistons, and the teens inside embraced all of it. They loved it.
Well, I love hearing this, and I don't want to get too serious in this episode because we are calling it 20 teens in a sweatbox. But when
you're going to drag it out of me.
I am going to drag it out
of me. Yes, you are.
But just really quickly, because we talked about this in season two, and we're right now at the end of 1964 in season three. So we're not at the civil unrest and the riots in 1967 yet. But when you were talking about Dave Leon and Punchy grabbing from other suburbs, if you will, from Detroit, did you ever hang out with black kids? Did they ever come? What was the demographic or the demographics going on there?
I remember Grosse Pointe being pretty darn white, frat and white. Did we hang out? Of course we did, because there were all different teen bands and we would go down to Plum Street and wherever. I mean, it was all a mixture, but it was that weird buildup of these teen bands from different demographics that made it a little different in Dave's Hideout atmosphere.
I love that. Well, one of the things that you told me in many of our private conversations, which just makes me giggle to no end, please tell our listeners what Dave Leon wanted to call the Hideout before it was the Hideout.
Oh, my God. Of course, you're talking about teens in high school used to going out on Friday nights, right? So the Quattro parents, I'll get to the Quattros, but Dave had wanted to have a place different than the chaperoned teen dances. You know, they were just limiting. You know, it was different, very different in the dance hops. So the first name was going to be called the Library. Oh, yeah, duh. You got to be kidding me. Like, these kids are getting dressed up in their bedroom, all gussied up, and they're going to tell their parents they're going to the library and that's going to fly. You got to be kidding. That idea went south real quick.
Well, but it is really funny, and it's exactly in the same vein of The Hideout, but The Hideout's a better name in the end, because I would have been that same student of who was a horrible student, putting on my clothes and leaving. Bye, Mom. Go into the library Friday
Oh,
night.
yeah,
Like, oh
sure.
no, you're not. Well, you brought up your parents, and I'm curious. You grew up in a musical family. Music was the family business. So
Yes.
were your parents okay with you going to the teen club?
Of course, these are teens in high school. A lot of them were driving, and they're used to their kids going out Friday nights. I don't remember there being a big deal. I don't know why Dave thought he might have to call it the library, because I don't think it was ever really an issue for the parents. Their kids were going to go out, whatever they were going to do on a Friday night. And my parents could have cared less. My dad was a freaking musician. He was like, go hear the live music, learn stuff, you know. So it was fine. And I don't remember Nan's parents or Diane's parents giving a hoot either. Now, as to other teens, there might have been some that were more strict that wanted to know, what are you going to do? Where are you going? What you doing? You know, I mean, the 50 questions before they walked out the door, who knows? But the hideout was wild and unchaperoned. The teens could let loose and they got to know that. No adults breathing down their necks. It became the hang. Everyone wanted to be at the hideout on Friday nights, and they were
That's
from all
fantastic.
over the city.
And I just want to, for the listeners out there, just in terms of chronology. So at this point, your sister Susie is still 14, you're 16, Nan and Diane are 17. So there is a huge mixture in terms of ages with the teens, but I just want to pull back a little bit and focus on 16-year-old Patty Quatro. And I want you to tell me, when you're thinking back, if you can go back in time, what comes to your mind when you think of this moment? Because I know you as a, you're a historian to me. You have a third eye, and I want, and but pretend you don't have that third eye. Be a teen. Tell us what it was like.
Well, you know, we were still teens. We weren't playing every Friday night. So we were attending. And then as it went toward December, the end of the year, obviously we might have had a gig now and then and weren't at the hideout. But most of the time we were, because we were working there when we weren't playing. And I was a normal teen. My God, I had my boyfriends and my friends, and you know, they knew what we were doing. It was really cool. Of course, do you know any teens with raging hormones that there aren't dramas going, you know, over boys? What was the drama of the moment? That shit went on all the time. We were always privy to our friends having huge crushes on some of the members of the bands or wanting an introduction to one of them. We even had some dating go on between us pleasure seekers and some of the boy bands. Now and then there was a romance going on for a
Oh,
little
oh,
while.
oh, oh,
Scott with Pris Wenzel. Nam Ball, I think she dated a couple from, I'm trying to remember who she dated, Spider from
Okay,
the
well,
Untouchables.
this is
Yeah,
so
I'm not sure.
insider. Okay, so
And
Pris
Dan
Wenzel.
Whitehouse was a real good looking guy in that band, and the girls loved him. I mean, you know, there were the favorites, and they were always bugging us because we were part of the guys. We were part of those bands.
Okay,
So
well,
they were
wait,
kind of.
Patty, you're so insider here. No, this is hilarious. I want to just tease it out. So when you say Pris Wenzel, that's a later member of Pleasure Seekers. We will talk about
Yes.
Pris. And in
Yes.
fact, there's a funny connection. One of our wonderful podcast listeners, Kevin Stewart, told me that he started a band in Grosse Pointe
Yes.
with Pris's little brother,
Oh
Pete.
my God.
And that Kevin used to listen to you guys rehearse. But putting that aside for a second, you said Pris dated Scott. Who is Scott, for those who don't know?
Scott Richardson, he started with the Chosen Few. He joined the Fugitives, and then he became Scott Richard Case. And he was one of the best band leaders in Detroit, I must say. He was a real strong guy and a very good front vocalist and very hot and loved by the women. Scott was a favorite. Oh, yeah. A great guy. And he was like a Renaissance man. He was such a sweetheart and deep. He thought about things a lot. So, you know, he's still a good friend to this day.
That's wonderful. Well, I don't want to jump the gun. You are still
No,
teenagers at the
later.
hideout, but you're again, Patty, you're being so coy here. What about you? Did you hook up with anybody during this time of people we may know?
Okay.
Come
Well,
on.
I'll be graphic and clear here because it is rock and roll and I love it, you know. I didn't fuck our bandmates. No. I was picking their brains about music constantly. It was all about the music. I had my boyfriends, but I didn't tend to mix in with the band guys. I'd say my third eye was more focused on the music and the happening scene in the growing era. We were in the growing era of sex, drugs, rock and roll, and it was coming in hard and heavy. I tended to keep my personal teen life a bit separate from the growing musical involvements with all those teen bands. So that's where I was at.
That sounds a lot like your father's voice coming into you,
Yeah, probably.
keeping it separate and understanding that separation. I think
Yeah.
that's fascinating. Well, since you, to
Oh
use
no.
your words, didn't
Oh
fuck
no.
anyone.
What are you going to pull out of me?
No, I want you to tell, you know that I'm not going to stop. We may stop on this episode for you, but I'm not stopping, my dear.
Oh my
But in
God.
terms of the hideout, it's late 1964 and it's nothing but horny teens in a sweat box. I want to remind you've already brought up the Quackenbush Brothers and the Fugitives. They were the first early house band. They were replaced by, they still play there, but replaced as the house band by the Underdogs. And
Right.
you did mention the back room. You did say that there was some drugs and some fun going on there and a lot of shenanigans, if that's the right word.
Oh, me and my big mouth. Go
Well, again, I'm not letting this go. But
Oh,
this
neither
leads
am
me
I.
to good. Well, this leads me to questions, and you actually touched upon this with your friends being interested in your homeboys. But
Right.
what was it like, or were there had to have been teen groupies at the time at the hideout. So let's talk a little bit about the obvious groupies, which would be female. But then I want to, after you answer that, I want to hear about, did you start to have male groupies?
Yeah, we'll get to that. Okay. Well, let's not gloss over in any way the infamous background, back room, since you want to go there so
Yes, I
much.
do.
It was disguised as a dressing room at the hideout. Truly an all-around area for the bands to get lucky, let off steam, and hang until they were on stage. It's all rock and roll, so I'm going to be a little bit graphic. I know that's okay. It was indeed the era of free love and sexual morality pushing the buttons heavily. The sexual revolution had definitely been building up in Detroit, coming right up quick. The back room at the hideout was quite busy with a few groupies of the day. Yes, we had them. One in particular. This is pretty graphic, but it cracks me up. She would give BJs and she would catch it in her compact and take it home. An interesting souvenir of her evening, I guess. And she got to be quite well known, but yeah, she was back there all
Wait,
the
wait, wait.
time.
I need to catch my breath here, but also I'm going to make you say that again because I just need to hear it one more time because then I have questions. Say it one more time.
She would give BJs to the bands in the back and catch it in her compact and take it home. I know it's like, ew, what? I
Ew, what? And also, our listeners can't
don't
see
know.
me. Is this like a mitt catcher thing? I
Yeah,
mean,
they used to laugh about it. I mean, she was well known for doing that. I don't know how many compacts she had, but maybe a collection like the groupies that used to take pictures,
oh my
you know.
God. Well, you know what? I think in this case, it's not a compact, but a compact.
Oh God. But let me clarify, the pleasure seekers did not partake in the backstage shenanigans. We hung out there when we were going to be on the bill. However, we were not naive and we were very cognizant of the raging hormones going on in the background any given Friday night. The back room had a spicy reputation for where the bands got lucky.
Did
All
you, even though you didn't necessarily do anything with the band guys, did you see the groupie girls back there seeing what they were doing?
Well, sure, if a door opened or something. I mean, we caught a lot. And you know, we were involved as musicians. We were part of the guys, okay? So They felt free enough to talk about it, to make jokes about it in front of us. They didn't care. We didn't care. It was part of the era. So, that's what happened. We were in the thick of it verbally, but we were not combat carrying queens or BJ givers.
And for people that don't know what a BJ is, we're going to let you just look that up all on your own and figure
Exactly.
it all out.
Exactly.
Well, Patty,
And
yep, go ahead.
oh, and let me add, I have to add Ted Nugent in there because he was known for playing every G string he could in the teen club. He definitely got around. And you know where we did our part? On stage, we added our own brand of sexuality. There was Nan. Dave used to laugh about this. In fact, he made comments at times. There was Nan in her sweater with no bra, singing "Wild Thing, You Make My Heart Sing," and the guys, beating the skins, and the guys would go wild for Nan. She had a very sexual look. So
Wow.
we did our part in a different way.
Absolutely. Well, that leads me to the second part of this question about whether you had male gropies. And well, let me rephrase that. When you and I were talking in season one about your time in the band Fanny, now this is 1974.
Right.
So it is a different sexual revolution that's happening then, and this is at the beginning of it. But you came up with such a clever line for the male groupies that you had in Fanny. You and Gene Millington used to call them gropies instead of
Yes.
groupies.
Yes.
So
Yes.
I'm wondering what the kind of, precursor male groupies were like at the hideout before you had gropies, and were they gropiettes? I don't, you know what I mean?
We had them from the beginning. I would say, there was always male groupies, if that's what you want to call them back then. They guys would hang out when we were coming, they would come around the van and they would offer to help. They were always, "Oh, can I help?" Da, da, da. They thought they were going to get lucky and hook up if they gave us some help. So they were always there, and that was how they became important to us, because we sure loved having the help. And they didn't get handy Andy at all. They were respectful, but you know what they were after. I mean, it was pretty obvious. They wanted to help us and get lucky and, get a little closer, meet us, and maybe hook up after the hideout. So, yep, they were there. Did they ever get lucky? Well, I'd say that's in the rock ether for each of us.
Oh no.
Oh my God.
I'm not letting it end there. You give one little anecdote, my dear, and then we will call it an episode, but I need one little tidbit.
What a way to die, eh?
Side.